This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to
the Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
It's August 27th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies.
And the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Humanism is a worldview based on reason, compassion, and creativity.
Duncan, I think today's show takes that definition quite literally, doesn't it?
Yeah, and literarily too.
Ooh, there you go.
What are some of the topics we're going to be covering in our two interviews today?
We're going to talk about feminism.
Yeah.
Actually, feminism in China.
Yeah.
History and literature of China.
Mm-hmm.
What else? We've got some other things from the East part of the world.
Yeah, it's kind of an East meets the West themed program. Globalization, technology, human labor, culture clashes, consumerism, communications, and business. All of that, folks, in 1 hour for free. Okay, so during the second half of the show, I am going to be speaking with an Indian humanist activist that's in India, the country, about working in a call center, actually.
In the first half of our show, we're going to hear from a professor from the University of Albany about this sort of myth and history of Chinese women warriors, as well as the state of feminism today in China.
Yes, as Americans, Jess and I have decided that it would be important to learn a little bit more about these two countries called India and China.
They play just a small role in our global economy.
Maybe. Okay, so but before we get to that, we have a very special and very quiet guest sitting here in the studio with us.
We do, and she's going to share some good news with our listeners.
Nancy Buxton is our development coordinator. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Well, this is great.
How do you like the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio?
It's very wonderful.
Yeah, it's so quiet that you can hear your thoughts really loudly. Which is a scary thing if you're like me.
If you're in Duncan's head, yes, that's a scary thing.
So, Nancy, you have some big news here for us regarding our podcast. What's up? What's the news?
Yes, it's very big news. We applied for and got a grant from the James Hervey Johnson Foundation for $25,000.
Yeah, $25,000 to help the HNN podcast upgrade our equipment.
And Duncan, no more Mickey Mouse microphone for you. And Jess, you can put away that duct tape.
Yeah. Sweet.
I don't know what we're going to do with all this with all these new toys. But so what's on the list, Nancy? We're going to be buying a new video camera, right, to do some video podcasts?
Yes. And I think that's one of the big things.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand a video podcast, but you guys seem sort of excited about it.
Yeah, although it's going to be a lot more work for us.
It is, and I'm not sure that our listeners, soon-to-be viewers, will appreciate this added sensory overload.
Yeah, basically a video podcast, you can subscribe just the way you do to the audio podcast, but you can actually see video footage on your iPod or on your computer screen.
Yep.
And we're definitely not going to be doing one a month for that.
So all those times where we said we were interviewing in Duncan's like laundry hamper.
Oh,
that's what I was just thinking of.
You get to see what it looks like. Or when I said he was here in his birthday suit.
Yeah.
Or when he was growing out his Darwin Day beard. I could keep going, folks.
I'm
going
to have to start shaving now for these things. But anyway, what we are going to do is we're going to be purchasing some professional quality equipment. Believe it or not, we're using pretty inexpensive recording equipment.
Yep.
Upgrading the computer is going to be a big expense. But I think when we're done, we will have basically radio quality equipment.
That's right. Equipment. Emphasis on equipment.
Yeah, not style or content. Watch out, world. Well, Nancy, this is awesome. Congratulations. You scored big.
Well, thank you very much. I, as you can imagine, am thrilled.
Awesome. Thanks, Nancy.
All right,
thank
take
you.
Care. Well, Jess, I guess we ought to begin the show, huh?
I guess so.
Fan Pen Li Chen is an assistant professor of Chinese studies in the University of Albany's East Asian Studies Department. She has a PhD in Chinese literature from Columbia University. One of her areas of specialization is women warriors in Chinese history and fiction. And she's also the author of several books, which we'll tell you about later. Professor Chen was born and spent her first 10 years in Taiwan. She later moved to Libya with her family before graduating high school in Seattle, Washington. My co-host, Jess Constantine, and Ruth Geller, editor of the Humanist Network News e-zine, spoke with Professor Chen this Monday.
I would love to hear about the history and the myth of the woman warrior in China.
I started the project reading a lot about Chinese woman warriors in Chinese novels, fiction, dating back to the Ming Dynasty to the 15th, 16th centuries. And women warriors also occurred quite frequently in Chinese drama, traditional Chinese operas. And in trying to find their roots, I started looking into Chinese history and decided that real Chinese generals, women, female generals, were very, very rare. Mm-hmm. They hardly ever existed. We can, however, trace back to the end of the Song Dynasty. This was 14th to 13th century BC. There was a woman, a female queen, who was one of the greatest warriors around. She led some of the very, very important generals at the time. Now, we don't have any record of her in Chinese histories. It wasn't until the beginning of the last century that we found her in the oracle bones, in the archaeological evidence. Hmm. She was mentioned there. And then during the 70s, during the last century, we found her tomb. It was one of the most greatest tombs that we found during that period. Lots of beautiful jades and bronzes in there. She was obviously the favorite wife of this king during that time. And she was something of a shamaness in that she did divination. Now, by the time Chinese history was written, it was based, the earlier periods were based on oral history. And she was at least 500 years before history was actually recorded. And somehow during the process of that, China had become patriarchal, much, much more patriarchal, mm-hmm. and patrilineal by then, so that memories of her just got conveniently erased from the oral tradition on which the written tradition was based.
That's kind of what happens to a lot of women in history. Their memories get erased.
Get erased.
Yeah.
After her, we don't have real women generals. We have stories like Mulan.
Right.
Okay, who was, there's no real historical record that such a person existed, although she could be traced to someone who may have existed, who was living in the borderlands of China,
which would be the barbarians. And,
the Chinese called
rebel groups.
The Chinese called all non-Chinese barbarians.
that's flattering.
Well, it's like the Greeks. Anything who's not of our civilization. But the one thing about Chinese that's different probably from the Western cultures is that anyone who adopts Chinese culture could become Chinese. So it's not ethnically based. It's mm-hmm. not whether you had, you know, curly hair or different a type of skin that determined whether you're Chinese or not. It's whether you're willing to use chopsticks instead of your hands. You start reading and writing. Mm-hmm. You adopt Chinese culture. Once you do that, you become Chinese. So it's a cultural thing and not a biological ethnic thing. Eventually, the woman warriors that I was able to find were real woman warriors, were among the barbarians, the foreign princesses, so chieftains, the daughters of foreign chieftains would be a princess somewhere in the mountains, mountain stockades, or in realms that were not in direct control. Mm-hmm. of the Chinese emperors. Those, the women there tend to be more militarily inclined and sometimes have more power than the women of the Han mainstream society. And that's where I found a lot of real, although it's very hard to find historical records to them, but we see them alluded in histories.
So Mulan, who, you know, famous, I guess, in the U.S. from the Disney movie of a few years ago, the
Mulan,
who might or might not be real. It sounds like there's no historical record of her. From what I had read, it seemed like she was mentioned in ancient Chinese ballads.
She's based, her story is based on a ballad from the Six Dynasties, probably around the 5th, 6th century AD. And this ballad talked about a girl who joined the army because her father was too old, but her father was on the rosters. And we noticed that later on during the ballad, she asked the Khan, not the Chinese emperor. And the Khan is a name for the king in Central Asia. They call them Khan, Kahan. And she asked the Kahan for her to go home, give her some camel. And it was not horse. Hmm. It was camel. She wanted a camel to go home. She didn't want to become a of course, by at that time, they didn't realize she was a woman, right? So the Khan wanted to give her an official post. She said, no, I just want a camel to go home. And this mention of camel, definitely Central Asian, the mention of Khan rather than a Chinese emperor is another indication that this story, this girl, was not from mainstream Chinese, but it became co-opted by the Chinese society. It's always been very, very important to the Chinese that all these peripheral ethnic groups are considered part of the Chinese culture. And when it's convenient, they also provide richness to the Chinese culture by having this female warrior who could become something important during the 20th century for women to become involved in more patriotic acts, to join the army. She became a very important figure in Chinese culture later on.
Even though she historically didn't exist, it sounds like, as opposed to some of the other women that you were
right, but she
mention.
Existed in a ballad, and that was good enough.
What do you think made her so important as a symbol to the Chinese state?
She was a woman of great filial piety. Now, loyalty can change. You can be loyal to a rebel group that eventually become the recognized group later. So loyalties can change, but filial piety, you know, your devotedness to the parents is one of the things that I find all over China. And she is a girl of great filial piety because she was going to the army on behalf of her father. Aged father.
She was fighting in his place, correct?
In his place, yeah. Right. So in her story, we see filial piety, and we also see loyalty to the state. We see a great valor. And later on, we find out in Chinese literature this great fascination with the female warrior figure.
We have that here in the U.S., but there is a big culture of video games in female warriors and
right. Xena,
absolutely,
TV.
And the Tomb Raider, like that Lara Croft, I think, played by Angelina Jolie on TV. But they can't have these women as warriors without also having them as some sort of sex symbol. Is that same element, is that present in China?
Very much so. Women warriors tend to be beautiful, exquisitely beautiful women who have, surprisingly, although most of them were foreign princesses and banded chieftains, they have small feet, small bound feet. They all look Chinese and they all speak Chinese. So in that sense, they are, they having small feet was, sure. was supposed to be very, very sexy in traditional Chinese culture.
Painful, though, for a woman, isn't it?
Very painful. Oh. Well, they would eventually get used to it, but when the feet were being bound, it was mm-hmm. a very, very painful process.
It seems almost impossible for a woman with small bound feet to ride horses and shoot and fight and engage in warfare.
One would think so. But I think the ideal of beauty is so much bound, linked up with small feet that people don't question it. They just figure, you know, to be beautiful, to be sexy, you have to have small feet. Mm-hmm. So they were all described with small feet.
It seemed like in some of the stories of women warriors, the male, they would marry a male figure, say a prince, who was kind of attractive, but maybe not as brave as they were, or not as strong
not
as they
as
were
strong as
in
they
some
were.
Ways, which is kind of interesting. But she would then shift her loyalty from her own family to his family,
right.
and fight and uh-huh. show valor on their behalf. But it's kind of interesting that the males were a little bit more passive.
Right. The males represented the Chinese state. They would be fighting for the Chinese state. They tend to be extremely handsome, sometimes beautiful mm-hmm. Male, that the foreign princesses would fall in love with. I think it's a male fantasy, and it's also a Chinese Sino-centered fantasy that the Chinese male is so attractive that foreign princesses would fall in love with them and pursue them until they marry the foreign princesses, and then the foreign princesses would fight for them,
right.
and as you say, in rebellion to their own family. That's been a main theme in the Chinese operas and novels.
So a warrior woman was strong and beautiful and loyal and faithful and et cetera, et cetera. Many,
right.
many incredible qualities that this one woman was supposed to possess.
Right, right. And you also find that these woman warriors tend to accept the polygamous situation.
That's an interesting aspect.
Very, very readily. So the male, the Chinese male, not only have one woman warrior helping him, everywhere he traveled, he'd pick up another wife who is just as dedicated. And these wives don't seem to complain that he would just move on and marry somebody else. They would be there waiting for him. They would be there collecting, training a whole army to help him later. Mm-hmm. So this is really, you know, a lot of male fantasy there.
Yeah.
Here. and the wives would later on meet with the other wives, or meet the children of other wives, mm-hmm. and they would be very, very happy to help each other. They call the other wives sisters. So you have this perfect mm-hmm. polygamous society, as far as a male person is concerned, where he could pick up as many wives as he needed
right.
to help him pursue his cause. And all the women get along beautifully with each other, and they all love him, and they all get along with each other. No problems.
I'm beginning to see why these are works of fiction.
And why a lot of people enjoyed reading
them. Absolutely. Absolutely.
One thing that was remarkable, you know, again, touching on the bravery and the valor of the female warriors, it extended to their giving birth. I read about, in some accounts, the women warriors would give birth to twins, and then very shortly just, you know, resume fighting, barely, you know,
fighting.
Missing a beat.
Right. One of the things that women warriors are associated with is the use of magical weapons. They tend to be better at it than the male warriors, and they tend to be able to use magic. That's why, although a lot of times they may not be as strong as the male warriors. They tend to win because they know how to use magic.
What's an example of a magical weapon or how they would use magic?
You may have a pair of golden scissors that somebody would offer up that would fly into the sky, and she has to chant a spell, and the golden scissors would go and cut up whoever it aims to cut up. That's why I also trace these woman warriors to shamanism. And they could cut up figures and entire armies using paper and using beans, and make them into entire armies to help them fight. And people actually follow them, believed in their magic, that they would win, but most of the time they end up losing. I think a lot of the women warriors who know magic are related to the female shamanesses. I know that a lot of shamanesses use swords, broad knives, to ward off devils and evil spirits. And when I was in China this past summer, I went to a little temple that I was able to witness a couple of the ladies, older elderly ladies, who use swords to ward off evil for the populace. There.
What were they doing exactly?
They usually do it when they are asked, when people come to them with special requests for them to chase off evil. Maybe the child was sick because they think it was possessed by some ghost, and these women would chase off the ghosts. They're not supposed to be performing. It's not like an opera that they would perform for tourists. Mm-hmm. So when I went there, I asked. At first, I thought this elderly lady was just helping out around the shrine. It was a very small temple. It was more like a shrine. And then it turned out that she actually presided over the rituals around there. And then she showed me things she hung inside her blouse. She had this little packet full of, there was a little horn, a little shell that she could blow with a little whistle-like thing there. The shamanesses always have these horns. And she had charms in there. So it occurred to me at one point that she was actually a female shaman. And then I asked her some more questions, and sure enough, she was. She said that some goddess came to her in a dream and told her to do it. So she started doing it, and it's, she said that shrine has been very efficacious. And in the morning, lots of people came to visit. So I said, do you use the sword to chase away evil spirits? She said, oh yes, she does. And I said, can you do it for us? I wanted to tape it. I want to see it. And she, you know, she was a little reluctant, and she was hum-ha. And then she said, well, there's another lady. She does it with this other woman. And the Chinese scholars who were with me realized that it's not something you ask a shamaness to do, because they do it upon request, not as a performance, but I persisted, and
you'd be a good reporter.
Eventually, she asked the goddess by throwing these divination block type things, and the goddess conceded. She said, "You know, we have scholars and some are from abroad. Do you mind if we do this for them to see?" And the goddess apparently conceded to it. So they did the sword brandishing, and I figure that's, you know, that is the female warrior image That's where the female warrior image came from for part of the Chinese tradition. And after she threw the blocks again, and she told me that the deity was happy, was very happy with it, and very happy that they did it for us.
Nice.
So I felt relieved. I was very didn't get her into trouble.
Yeah, and you didn't get on the deity's bad side either.
That's
always a good thing.
You're listening to an interview with Professor Fan Pen Li Chen, conducted by Jess Constantine and Ruth Geller. In the next segment, we're going to be hearing about shadow theater and feminism in China.
Fan, I was wondering if you could tell us how you first got attracted to this area of Chinese history and literature, the woman warrior.
Mm-hmm. I did my PhD dissertation on a female queen, and that started a series of research on the imaging of women in Chinese literature. I've dealt with both history and various genres. Drama was one of the genres, and novels were another. During one of the conferences I attended, an editor of a journal, I think it was a journal on religion, she approached me and said that she was doing a special edition on women warriors who related to religion from all over the world. And she asked me if I could do a paper on that. And I thought, woman warriors, not too many people work with Chinese woman warriors. Let me look into that. And also it has something to do with religion. But when I discovered that women warriors in Chinese fiction use magic, she said, oh yes, magic is definitely religion. I said, okay, I will work on a paper on that. So I did a paper for her on that, and that started digging deeper into various aspects of women, Chinese women in history that were warriors, as well as women warriors in fiction. When I started working on the Shadow Theater project, one of the things I always asked the various performers I met was, do you have plays that dealt with women warriors? And if they did, I, you know, asked them to include it in the performance when they performed for me. So that's what I've been doing research on until fairly recently, last year, when I published the second book, that I want to leave the Shadow Theater project for a while now. I'm moving on to Chinese puppetry, the non-Shadow Theater forms of Chinese puppetry.
Just to get back to the woman warriors, I'm wondering, you know, feudalism, monarchy, communism, through all these forms of government and governing, is the image of the woman warrior, did that stay alive?
Well, you see warrior type women in the Communist Party. There are lots of in the Chinese military, there were women cadres and female soldiers and officers in the Chinese modern Chinese army. The woman warrior motif has pretty much survived many of the upheavals of Chinese history.
She's shown her strength.
Yes.
If women warriors are typically there to serve the Chinese state, it seems like Chinese feminists would need to create their own archetypal image of female strength to inspire them.
I think during communist China, there is what's known as state-sponsored feminism.
Really?
So there was feminism, but it was supported by the state. The state would say, well, you know, all the men and women should be treated equally when they apply for jobs. When you graduate, the state assigns where you would work, right? And women had equal chance as men in finding, in getting the positions. But ever since the market economy took over during the early 80s, the state-sponsored feminism has eroded, and Chinese women are thinking of individualism along with feminism. It's no longer the state version of feminism anymore. And a lot of women nowadays feel that it is their right to want to stay home and not work. In the past, it was, you know, the state feels that it's a woman's right to work, so all the women should work. But now women are saying, well, we want to stay home and raise children, and see that as part of a feminist movement in a different way from before. There was a time when all women wore suits, and that was a feminist type thing to do.
The unisex garb?
Right, the unisex garb. But now, most women I saw in China were better dressed than I was when I was there. And they were very, very much, very conscious of looking more effeminate than most people I meet in the States. Mm-hmm. So you see a backlash of the state feminism versus what's developing now. And to the point that I'm not sure how to define feminism anymore.
Mm. Seems like it comes down to having choices,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps having the choice to stay home after the state telling you have to work is an attractive choice for some people.
Right. On the other hand, without state feminism, what we're finding is that women have are less likely to get the best jobs, because a lot of people who do the hiring decide that young women particularly would spend a lot more time than men would on raising a family. And they would not be as productive for the company or for the agency as men would be. So, you know, there were advantages to state-sponsored feminism and disadvantages, of course, in all things.
There's a saying that, you know, if women ruled the world, then it would be a very, like, peaceful, you know, very peaceful place, and everyone would get along, and we'd think about children and nature and flowers and stuff. And so,
what kind of flowers?
Oh, I don't know. Lilies.
Daisies?
Lilies.
And okay. Daisies. And daisies.
I'm just wondering, though, if do you think that's true? Like, if you add this flavor of women who are also warriors, or women who are, and we have women in the military now.
The women warriors in Chinese fiction are there to serve the male world. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult for me to transplant them into a female world and see how they would have done. It was definitely a male creation.
Mm-hmm. So there were no female authors who wrote about female warriors? That's a shame.
No,
true.
there was a female author who wrote about female fantasy of being part of the male world.
Interesting.
Of being able to disguise herself as a man and pass the examinations and become an official. Well, was offered the job of a high minister. Mm-hmm. That was a female fantasy. But in terms of women warriors, I think they were a male fantasy. I think during, I have to do more research into this, but I think during the Ming Dynasty, the Chinese pushed more and more into minority areas, and where they encountered with tribes, matrilineal tribes, tribes where women had more power and had more physical abilities, militarily speaking. And this was the way that the Chinese mentality, in the perfect Chinese Han world, these women warriors would be co-opted by the Han Chinese, would marry into the would marry the Chinese generals who go out there. And it's a reflection of a historical trend. But it's hard to know how these female warriors would have been if the world were different in real life or in fiction.
Thanks for being here with us, Van.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
We were just listening to an interview between Jess, Ruth Geller, editor of the Humanist Network News e-zine, and Professor Fan Pen Lee Chen of University at Albany. Professor Chen is the author of Chinese Shadow Theater, Its History, Relation to Popular Religion, and Portrayal of Women Warriors, published by McGill in 2007. She also wrote Visions for the Masses, Chinese Shadow Plays, published in 2004. They both sound very interesting. I really enjoyed that, Jess. I haven't been in college in a while, and I felt like I was sitting in on a very interesting class in college.
Yeah, I would love to take one of her classes.
Well, I felt like I was sitting in on an interesting class that I was taking pass-fail. Because those were always the most fun, right?
Exactly.
Take the pressure off. Well, Jess, with globalization, we live in a world where we're continually interacting with people on the other sides of the planet.
That's correct.
You know, you make a phone call sometimes for tech support for, you know, as our tech director, right? You make a phone call for tech support and you get someone who's in India, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
It's like the middle of the morning for them, too.
More often than not, actually.
Yeah. And we don't even think about it anymore. The world is getting so small. Who's even listening to this podcast? It could be in Iceland, Australia, whatever. Anyway, I decided I wanted to actually seek out and talk to one of these people who provides us a service on the phone, who's there talking to us on the phone. So I found a young man. He's a humanist activist in India by day and a call center employee by night. His name's Gurinder Singh Azad, and he is a board member of the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization. But we're going to be talking about some of the work he did as a call center employee in India. Pronouncing people's names correctly is very important to you. So why don't you tell me right now, how do I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, my name in Punjabi? I mean, in my accent?
Well, I don't know. How do you want me to say your name? How would people say it?
It's Gurinder Singh Azad.
And do you so Azad is your last name?
Yes.
Tell me about that. I've met a lot of people from India, they go by their last name a lot? People just call them by their last name, or how does that work?
It's a tradition over there. You know, people go with their last name. They prefer.
They prefer to go by their last name?
Yes.
Azad. And what's your full name again?
Gurinder Singh Azad.
Gurinder Singh Azad?
Yeah, very correct.
Why is pronouncing people's name correctly, why was it very important to you in your recent job?
In fact, I do work for an American call center.
Yeah.
And our American consultant taught me the first lesson of in BPO. To stay in BPO, this is very essential that, you know, you call the name of people, you know, in a very correct manner so that they never come to know that we are calling from India. So if they will come to know, they will not buy the product, you know?
Yeah. So let's take a step back and bring our listeners up to speed. So you worked in a call center. An American calls a phone number
yes.
to find out how to fix their computer or how to do this or do that.
Yeah.
They call a phone number.
Yep.
And the person who answers the phone is in India.
Yes.
And you're saying that it's important when you were doing this job, this is the job you had.
Yes.
It was important that you were able to, what, to pass off as...
Say, your name is Duncan Crary.
Yeah.
Okay. And if I say that, you know, am I speaking to Duncan Crary?
Mm-hmm.
So you will come to know that, you know, this person is not familiar with the American, you know, style.
Mm.
So you will have some doubt then, you know, over the telephone, someone is befooling me or whatever. So, you know, you will not buy the product. So finally, my job is to sell product, so I will get the incentive from that.
What kind of training did you have to go through? What were people telling you where you worked? Were they telling you how you need to act this way? You need to be able to pass off as American? What were they telling you?
It was American people. So, and there was a special training on accent, on voice clarity, and on, you know, how American think even. I mean, so that the sale pitch should move according to the trend of thinking of American people.
Yeah.
You know, in that way. So, there was a special training of 1 month. And
what kinds of things were they telling you? You gotta tell what kinds of things were they telling you that Americans need to hear? You know, give us the juice.
American are very expressive as compared to Indian, definitely. And if they have some confusion or they are skeptic about the call, then immediately they will hang up. If we do so. Any silly mistake, it will be over without any lead, without any sale. So we have to be very specific. Top of that, there was a monitoring department, you know, who used to monitor all the calls. If there is any...
Anyone could be listening in on you at any time, like Big Brother, just listening in. And
yes.
If they don't like the way you're doing it,
done. Yes. Say, you know, we used to make 400 to 450 calls. In our night shift, and hardly we could make sale of maybe 5 maximum, or maybe 6. Of course, girls were able to make sales because of the girls can do it. So, but the boys,
you're saying people are more forgiving of women than men.
Yes. Yes, of course, there was a lot of time there was flirt with the girls, you know. If a girl is calling that, you know, you buy our credit card or whatever, and the boy will say that, you know, from the American boy, and that I'll buy 2 product, but first, you know, you have to come with me. Your voice is so sexy, and I would like to meet you, you know.
Meanwhile, you're on the other side of the planet.
There's
no chance that they're ever going to meet.
Yeah. So in that way, you know, it was funny.
So this is your job. You have to behave a certain way in order to do your job well. But then after you're done with your job for the day, did you find yourself and your friends going out on the town and acting American, you know?
No. Actually, to be very frank and honest, we all are Punjabi people over there, you know. Punjabis, they have a very typical accent, Punjabi, and they don't feel comfortable while speaking in English. But they have to speak because this is their profession. So we are restricted not to speak Punjabi in the company's premises, okay? Otherwise, our 1 day salary will be deducted. Okay, so yeah, this
one
was
day there. Salary deducted.
Yes, if we use Punjabi. even with each other. So we in the lunch time, which is not the lunch time, of course, because it is almost 2-3 p.m.
Yeah,
you know,
no 2-3 in the morning. You're saying
no p.m.
Oh,
a.m. Yeah. Sorry, and we used to go outside the premises of the company, then we literally use Punjabi abuses, you know, like so that our jaws may be relaxed, you know. We keep on speaking English and our jaws are, you know, really get paining because we are not familiar with it. So we used to, you know, it was all fun.
Tell me something, because I have been on a call center call before where I got kind of angry, not at the person, but just at the situation, okay? Mm. And when you're on the telephone, you sometimes forget that you're dealing with a human being.
Yeah.
Okay, just like when you're doing the email, you sometimes forget you're talking to an actual human being.
Yes.
Do you have any stories of people just treating you horribly on the phone?
Oh, yeah. It's every day's story. Every day we have to face that situation. Sometimes people are, as you're saying, that, you know, some people are maybe have done their night shifts, maybe sleeping in the daytime, and maybe, you know, they have some other problem, and they don't want to talk to anyone. They want to live in solitude. And there is our call. That is top of that, which is a sale call. And, you know, he literally blasted on us, and with the, you know, heavy abuses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, but, you know, it was because our names were never, I mean, like my real name is Gurinder, but my call center name was Boris. Okay. So, our consultant told us that he's abusing Boris, not you. Okay? Yeah, you are not Boris. You are pretending to be Boris. Okay? And the person who is abusing you over the telephone, maybe because his mood is off, and don't take it personally, because he's not abusing you. Abusing Gurinder. He's abusing Boris.
Does that work? I mean, does that really work? Were you able to have this dual personality?
Yes, we do.
Really?
I mean, in the company premises, I was Boris.
But I mean, someone's on the phone, they're angry with you.
Yeah.
And
and what?
And they're just like abusing you. Do you want to role play right now? I want to role play with you right now. Okay, you call me on the phone right now, and I'm going to be...
Okay.
But you're Boris, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to pretend it.
Okay? Yeah, okay, ring, ring.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Am I talking to Duncan Crary?
Yeah, this is me. Yeah.
Mr. Duncan, this is a call from Sia Bangkok Company.
Look, I don't have time for this kind of stuff.
Okay, so may I know when...
No, and look, I'm not interested, okay? Listen, you're calling me at home right now. I don't want to talk to you.
But
I'm angry. Do people call you at home? How do you feel when people call you at home?
In fact, there's a great offer for you. So
listen, I've had enough. Click.
Yeah, this was a user practice. This was a user practice. Some people used to say that, you know, we don't have time. So we asked them, may I know when would you have time?
Yeah, and there's never
and,
a good
and,
day.
Yeah, and he will say, I never would have time. So it means that, you know, he will never buy our product. So
yeah, but
we
I could not do that every day. I would get so angry at the people. I wouldn't, you know, I being treated. It's a dehumanizing way to be treated, right?
Yes, of course. But, you know, we are taught not to take these things so personally or seriously, because we are not. I mean, if this is Gurinder who is working over there, but on the floor, when a person is calling, it's not Gurinder, it's a Boris who is calling.
And you
so
were
that's
really,
a dual personality
yeah.
we have to survive with.
And you were able to really do that. You were able to just separate.
Everybody is doing this.
But come on, there must have been one or two phone calls that just made you want
to... Of course. People, you know, in the very beginning of this career in BPO, people, when they come across such kind of callings or such kind of responses, and they might, you know, they might got upset, and you know it's a dehumanizing way of treating people.
Yeah.
You know, they are treating and they leave their job, and you know they might explore some other opportunity.
Well, what about you though? You finally had it, right? You're not doing this anymore.
There was a good money involved in this, actually. So just because of the money factor, I could tolerate all these things.
Azad says that call centers in India act as individual manufacturing companies. They come complete with their own employees and the equipment necessary to get the job done. All that an American company needs to do is to pay a fee to the call center, and everything else is taken care of. According to Azad, it could cost a U.S. company a quarter of the price, possibly less, to outsource this type of work to India, as opposed to paying Americans to do this work in the U.S. In fact, Indian labor is so cheap that many individual Americans are hiring personal assistants in India to take care of all their phone and email chores.
So in this way, you have saved your energy, your money, and, you know, your lot of other things, infrastructure maybe. And on the other hand, you know, there is an employment in India also.
I guess I'm curious to hear your attitude about this. I mean, this is basically turning human beings into a commodity, which is not the first time it's happened. I mean, human beings as a commodity is, for labor.
Yeah, this is a very humanized question, I would say. In fact, it's all against nature, I think, because, you know, it's a system of nature that, you know, you sleep in the night and you work in the day. Okay, whatever. So, but here it's a vice versa that our shift was started at 1:30 and whole night we had to work. We keep on, you know, we had a headphone on our ears. So we keep on doing the stuff. So, you know, people have some problems. In the daytime, there is a noise outside. There is a light outside. So you don't really feel. And of course, there is a marketing people, you know, all the time knocking the door or, you know, bringing the bell. So doorbell. And, you know, you can't have a sound sleep of one stretch. You understanding?
Yeah, because you're trying to sleep during the day.
Yes. And it is also important that, you know, you have to have sleep. So people sometimes, it's a very bad thing that, you know, sometimes they have started taking drugs so that, you know, they may have a sound sleep. It's a bad experience. And it's a target-oriented job. If you don't achieve your target, you will be kicked out. And you always have fear of this thing. And, you know, at the weekend, you try to stress, you release your stress and using alcohol and a lot of alcohol and, you know, a lot of other things which are inhuman maybe. And as such, they are spoiling their youth. So doing call center job means no other thing to do. Okay, no ability and no charm and nothing. I mean, they just do sex maybe. You know, they use sex as a tool to maybe refine them, maybe to, you know, to bring out of that stress maybe. So as such, you know, things are moving. So there is a different culture is in, you know.
So you're saying people who get roped into these jobs, they're going out and getting drunk and having sex to get a release from the stress of this job, which turns your world upside down.
Yes,
and there's all sorts of risks involved in,
of course,
you know, that, of course.
Of course. Of course. Huge risks are there. And there is, you know, one thing more, which is, I think, is there. Talking to America, they started thinking in the American way.
That's people. What I was trying to ask you about earlier.
People, you know, they think that, you know, they are not exactly the Indian. Maybe they should have a life of American style. And America has an open sex life, right? And which India is not. So they feel that, you know, they are little superior than the person who was saying that there shouldn't be sex before marriage. You getting my point? So this kind of, you know, detachment from the society is taking place.
Because their hours are so different, Azad says that many young Indian call center employees don't know other young people the same age as them outside of work. To make up for this, the companies provide a gym, a billiards hall, and a pool.
So they are, you know, they are detached from the entire society, in fact.
What's the alternative? Why do people take these jobs? What's the alternative to taking this kind of a job?
One thing is that, you know, population is terrible in India. And another is that, you know, every year there are a thousand, maybe in lakhs of graduates coming up from the colleges or universities. And the jobs are not in accordance with the population that is coming up. So, and, you know, the corporate sector and the media has highlighted everything in such a manner that, you know, there's a consumerism has come up that, you know, they should have everything, every facility. If they have some TV, maybe you know, of low quality, they will go for higher quality. Maybe then they will go for higher quality. I mean, they want to consume everything.
Yeah.
They have developed this habit. So since call center is giving them good skills, paying skills, you know, good salaries and good infrastructure, okay, and good environment, people are allured. Youth is allured with this thing. And top of that, they don't have any other opportunity. A call center's job is numerous. I mean, you go there in any call center, you know, you don't need to look that, you know, if they have any opening or not. They always have an opening for you. If you have capability, you can speak English, and in America style, you know, good salary is yours, no problem.
It sounds like what you're saying is that consumerism is like a drug. I mean, it's being exported from America, I think.
No.
Please, you don't think
please.
So?
No. It's not there. It's not the thing. It's in India. You know,
Azad was really quick to correct me. It's not Americans bringing these things over to India. It's Indians themselves. They want these things. They see the ads on the TV channels and they want to buy whatever they see. And it's not just American companies outsourcing their work and indirectly their lifestyles to India. Other companies in other countries are doing the same thing.
I see your point, which is not to blame this on America. It's not America,
yeah.
But it's like people refer to themselves a lot of times as consumers. It's a very unhealthy thing to refer to oneself as a consumer.
Yes.
Because a consumer has no responsibility to do anything but consume.
Yes, this is a very bad habit. And you know, you are a youth, so you are well aware that, you know, any country, you know, will survive if their youth is coming up in a better way. In a better way, better way means they are socially, they are healthy. Socially healthy means their mind is healthy. It is progressive. They think critically. They think they have reason, you know. And they are not just they don't treat everything as a product. But with all this, they have started to think that if his father would have been a billionaire, their situation might not had been this. You understanding me? So in money, they are not looking at the positive aspect that they have provided the education to them, but they have thinking that, you know, their father should have been rich. This is a very bad thing, and they feel humiliation if their parents are illiterate, say. They don't know how to speak. They don't know English, or they don't have the, you know, updated and modern stuff in the home. So that kind of feeling is there. And they are, you know, to work for poor, to work for humanism is a, you know, I mean, it's a gone case for them. They are not for this purpose, at least. They just want to be a healthy life, wealthy life. And they just want to consume everything. That's it.
The tables could turn, okay? And I want to know, people would think this is preposterous, but Americans could find themselves in the same situation that Indians are in right now. We could be the ones in the future who are having the call center jobs, right? It's not impossible.
It is possible. One thing I have gained from, you know, from America's news, maybe, I have seen George Bush saying that, you know, that if American families are unable to produce the laureates, the PhD scholars, you know, we will have to take assistance of India and China. You will have to bring people from India and China, the scholars. Okay? It means that there is some problem is going on that, you know, people, the youth of America is not interested in going for higher education, maybe.
What's the lesson for Americans to gain from this? I mean, suppose the shoe were on the other foot.
I think, you know, we should... It's not an easy task for me to, you know, purify everything, you know, and then, you know, I should give you the conclusion that, you know. But, of course, there is something going which is not soothing for any society. It's not neither for India nor America. In India, youth is getting spoiled. And in America, of course, people are having trouble with this because, you know, most of their jobs are outsourced now. You know, the American boys could have that job, you know, the youth, but now it is with the Indian people. And India is growing, no doubt. But, you know, it's economically it's growing, but socially it's going backward. And for America, I mean, a beautiful country, you know, literate people and developed country, superpower. I am too pygmy to give any kind of suggestion, I think. But I would say that, you know, I am very much aware of how society can grow. America is not an exception, so I can say that, you know, you have to go with the healthy environment so that your offsprings, the coming generation, can have some positive thing from that. It's not about the consumerism. It's about the social and moral values, which are important. You know, a child, a born child, is like a, you know, wet soil. You can give any shape to it, you know. It's in the hand of parents how they want to make their child. It is very important. It is a huge thing that, you know, how parents give education to their child. Sometimes they ignore it, you know. They think that, you know, it's teacher's responsibility who are teaching them, or maybe the school is going, it's their responsibility. But no, what you can give to your child, no one can on this earth but you only. So problem with my society is there in India, and you have your problem in here in America. So you have to find the solutions with the reason, with the critical thinking, with the logic. So going logic is a great thing. I think parents have to have this knowledge, and then they should transfer this knowledge to their kids.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Tangan.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Wow, I don't envy Azad. That's not a job that I would want.
No, but I do like the fact that, you know, he was talking about call center employees working late at night and then trying to sleep during the day and being interrupted by salespeople at the door and on the phone. I mean, we're all sort of victims of this.
Yep.
And he was one of those guys selling stuff too, so.
450 calls a day, though.
I know. It's insane. You have a headset on, you just go, 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 go. Maybe get 5 sales.
Wow.
I did talk to Azad. I went out afterwards, had a drink with him at the conference.
Of course.
Yeah, in Washington, where I met him. And he did remember that one of his coworkers was actually sort of escorted out by, you know, like a psych team because he had a psychotic breakdown.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and just started saying, can I help you? Can I help you? Can I help you? To everybody.
Serious?
Yeah. Which, I mean, we both kind of burst out laughing at first, but that's actually kind of a serious,
yeah,
you know, it's really sad, but kind of a tragic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, that wraps up today's show, right?
Yeah. Well, it does, but I think we heard from a listener that we'd like to play one of those comments, right? You want to play that listener comment?
Sure.
All right, let's hear that.
The reason why I'm calling you is it seems that many people in the humanist field are attached to the sciences, especially in the new atheism movement. And, of course, science plays a big modus operandi of just epistemologically and how we gain knowledge. But it seems that there's very little room for the humanities in discussion, whether it be theater or literature. And I think that's because literature, especially in theory, in literary theory, in the last couple of years have been going the way of post-structuralism, which is based on very subjective views of objective reality. There is no objective reality in the postmodern structuralist view. And I don't know if you want to comment on that. My name is Chaz Minna, and I'm in Harlem, NYC. Bye-bye.
Okay, Jess, I know you have a lot to say about objective reality and postmodern structuralist, the postmodern structuralist view, right?
Yeah, as soon as I look that up, I'll have an answer for you there, okay?
Okay, but anyway, Chaz, I think you make a good point, though, that there's a lot of, there isn't enough talk about the art, and there's not enough talk about the creativity part.
Right.
You know, reason, compassion, creativity. So I hope you enjoyed our literary discussion we had today.
Yep. And on the flip side, Duncan, there's a lot of talk about other aspects of humanism, but there's not a lot of action.
Yeah, that's right.
And
a
so
lot of talk.
It's a project that you and I are going to start, right? We're going
to. That's right, listeners. And you're going to need to read the Humanist Network News e-zine to learn more about it. But basically, Jess and I are putting the human back in humanism.
One human at a time. Wait a second.
Well, on that note, you've been listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. If you'd like to leave us a listener comment, please do so by calling 877-659-1515.
To learn about the music we played during shows, to listen to previous programs, or to read transcripts, visit humaniststudies.org/podcast.
And read our weekly e-zine, including how Duncan and I are putting the human back in humanism, at humanistnetworknews.org.
We've been podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio. To learn more, visit imaginenosuperstition.com.
The Humanist Network News podcast is the official podcast of the American Humanist Association and a project of the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.